This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines. Iran warns the EU against, quote, any uncalculated move one day after the bloc said that it was mulling restrictive measures against Tehran over the recent events in the country. Israeli forces gunned down another Palestinian in the West Bank. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli attacks in the occupied territories this year. And Russia's ambassador to the U.S. warns that Washington's continued weapons supplies to Ukraine increase the risk of a direct confrontation. Thanks for joining us. Iran vows effective response and a tit-for-tat action if the European Union takes hasty and unthinking measures over Tehran's approach to the recent riots in the country. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian also expressed discontent with some European officials' stances on recent developments in Iran. Amir Abdollahian made the remarks in a phone call with his Italian counterpart Luigi Di Maio. That is a day after the bloc said that it was mulling restrictive measures against Tehran in the wake of recent riots and unrest. Riots erupted after a young woman died in a hospital after being taken by police. The Islamic Republic says a thorough and fair investigation is underway to ascertain the exact cause of her death, which was used as a pretext for rioting and vandalism. Meanwhile, the Iranian Foreign Ministry summoned the British ambassador to lodge a protest against the UK government's stance on the recent events in the country. A senior Russian diplomat has criticized the Canadian government for sanctioning Iran's English-language news network, Press TV, calling it a sign of Western leaders' weakness. Russia's permanent representative to international organizations in Vienna says the recent move by Canada points at the authoritarian trends in the West. According to Mikhail Olyanov, Western governments leave no space for different views to compete. Instead, they dictate and brainwash people into believing that what they want to believe. Earlier, Ottawa imposed sanctions on Press TV and 33 other Iranian individuals and entities over alleged human rights violations. Canada and Iran have had no formal diplomatic relations since 2012. Author and journalist Arnold August believes Canada follows U.S. policies when it comes to Iran and many other countries.
The Canadian government, over the last few years, with regards to many countries, but specifically with regards to Iran, they simply use the U.S. State Department and White House talking points against Iran. So that is the pretext, that is so-called repression of women in Iran. Interesting, coming from a country, Canada, a colonial settler state that is now famous throughout the world for having committed and still commits genocide against the native peoples in our country, they are in a position, a moral position, to judge Iran with regards to the question of human rights. I mean, it is basically a regime change effort pushed forward by the United States and Canada, unfortunately, as a very close and faithful ally of the United States, is following through on it by adding these sanctions.
The dual Iranian-American citizen Bakr Namazi arrives in Oman following his release from detention in Iran. Namazi left Tehran earlier Wednesday after 6.5 years in custody. He is set to travel to Abu Dhabi to undergo a carotid surgery before he heads to the U.S. Iran's foreign ministry says the 85-year-old was released on humanitarian grounds. Oman has thanked the Islamic Republic for facilitating his release. Namazi, a former official with the UN Children's Agency UNICEF, was one of four Iranian-Americans, including his son Siamak, detained in Iran in recent years, or barred from leaving the country. He was convicted of collaborating with what Tehran said was a hostile government in 2016 and sentenced to 10 years in jail. A court in Belgium has reportedly lifted the ban on extradition of Iranian diplomat Asadullah Asadi, who is held in a prison in the European country. The court's judgment now paves the way for exchanging Asadi with a Belgian national imprisoned in Iran. The exchange, if implemented, is part of a prisoner swap between Brussels and Tehran. Belgium had ratified a treaty allowing prisoner exchange with Iran. However, a Belgian court of appeal in July stopped the country from extraditing Asadi, who was arrested 4 years ago. Asadi was detained while serving in the Iranian embassy in Austria and was later transferred to Belgium on unproven allegations. He was handed a 20-year jail term on charges of plotting an attack against an anti-Iran terror group, MKO. Iran says Asadi is illegally held, which also violates his diplomatic immunity. There seems to be no end in sight to Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. Regime forces have killed one more Palestinian during a raid on the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 21-year-old Ala Zagal succumbed to injuries after he was shot in the head by Israeli troops. The ministry says at least two others were also injured during the Israeli operation near the city of Nablus. Israel has intensified its deadly crackdown against Palestinians. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli attacks across the occupied territories this year so far. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with details on the latest killing of a Palestinian by Israeli forces.
Israeli forces stormed the town of Deir al-Hatab, East Nablus, and confrontations took place between Salman Omran, who was in his house with his wife and family members. Clashes continued for almost 2 or 3 hours. During these confrontations, as you have mentioned, a Palestinian man was shot dead, Ala Nasser Zaghal, 21 years old, from Deir al-Hatab. A number of Palestinians had been wounded, including two journalists, a cameraman and a journalist working with the official Palestine television channel. Following these clashes, unfortunately, the Israeli forces succeeded to arrest this Palestinian fighter after killing one Palestinian and wounding at least four others, including two Palestinian journalists.
The U.S. announces a new batch of military aid to Ukraine amid Russia's repeated warnings about the consequences of more weapons supplied to Kiev. According to a statement by the White House, the new package is worth $625 million. It includes HIMARS rockets, artillery systems, ammunition, and armored vehicles. During a phone call with the Ukrainian president, U.S. President Joe Biden has pledged to impose severe costs on any individual or entity that backs Russia's offensive. He also said that Washington will continue to support Ukraine for as long as it takes. Meanwhile, Russia's envoy to the U.S. has warned that Washington's weapons supply to Kiev increases the risk of a direct confrontation.
The supply of military products by the U.S. and its allies not only entails protracted bloodshed and new casualties, but also increases the danger of a direct military clash between Russia and Western countries.
The Russian diplomat also said that Moscow perceives U.S. military assistance to Kiev as an immediate threat to its strategic interests. The latest package brings the total value of Washington's military aid to more than $17.5 billion. Russia is regrouping its forces and gearing up for a counterattack in response to new advances by the Ukrainian army. Russian officials in Kherson say that they are preparing to deliver a retaliatory blow. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has said that Kiev is making rapid gains in the south and has already retaken dozens of villages in the regions of Kherson, Luhansk, and Donetsk. Those are the very regions that Moscow declared it was annexing days ago after holding referendums there. Russia has pledged to use all of its power to protect the regions integrated into its territory. Ukraine and its Western allies have dismissed the referendums as illegal. President Joe Biden has said that the U.S. will never recognize Russia's annexation of Ukrainian territory. Jenny Miller joins us from Donetsk to tell us more about the latest developments. Jenny, at this point, what are we looking at? First of all, is the news accurate about how Russia is getting prepared for a counterattack to retake, I guess, territory that it has lost? If you can tell us about the authenticity of that, and of course, any developments there that you deem important.
Well, any Russian counterattack isn't clear at the moment. What I can tell you is what you've just been reporting is accurate. Ukraine has been making some major military gains in Kherson, in the Kherson region. They have been taking back some towns there, and also in the north of the Donetsk region around Lyman. They've also made some advances there. And I've just got back from a frontline village just outside Gorlovka. There, the Russian line is holding strong, and indeed in Barmut, a major settlement to the north of that, it's the Russians that are going forward, attacking that settlement. But just to the north of them, it's the Ukrainians that are making big ground. I asked some pro-Russian fighters, pro-Russian civilians, are you concerned about these Ukrainian advances just to the north of you? The general feeling is that they are not. They're very confident that the Russian or pro-Russian lines will hold there. But Russia will certainly be hoping that their 300,000 mobilized soldiers will get there as soon as possible to stabilize those lines. There is a lot of dissatisfaction from Russian journalists criticizing the Russian military establishment for allowing Ukraine to take back this territory, but also a feeling, I think, from Russia that they're confident that they will be able to stop Ukraine taking too much more. There's also a feeling that the next couple of weeks or month is a very important time in terms of the fighting. Why? Because not just to try and for Ukraine to take back this territory before Russian reinforcements arrive, but also because winter is coming. In winter, it's going to be much harder for the forces trying to gain territory, forces on the offensive, and much easier for the defending side. So the Ukraine, heavily backed by the United States, of course, the United States will be very keen for Ukraine to try to take as much territory back of these four regions as it can before reinforcements arrive and before winter.
And what are your thoughts about how the news has come out that the Ukrainian president Zelensky has signed a decree saying that it's not going to go for peace talks with Russia?
Well, yeah, that for anybody interested in peace in Ukraine, that's a very depressing statement. Vladimir Putin, when he was announcing the Russian takeover of these regions, did say that he was ready for peace talks. And there is very clearly, this is an opportunity for peace talks, a very bitter peace negotiations for Ukrainians to swallow, as Vladimir Putin has made clear that the four regions are not under negotiation. But it is also an opportunity for Ukraine to say, well, maybe this might be the best that we can get. But it looks like Zelensky is not going to take that opportunity. Zelensky, it's difficult to see just how much power Zelensky has in Ukraine. The United States, particularly Britain, the EU, are propping up Ukraine financially. So they really call the shots in Ukraine more than Zelensky, to be frank. And it looks like the Americans are very keen to continue the war. There'll also be another opportunity for peace talks in the winter. Of course, the economic crisis is coming to Europe with the gas supplies that are no longer coming through Russia. So you can't expect many European politicians, European people to start demanding that maybe peace is the best solution for Ukraine. But at the moment, the United States and Ukraine are determined to try and take back as much of this territory in the next few weeks as they can.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Jenny Miller there from Donetsk. Thank you. Moving on, the German economy minister has accused the U.S. of charging too much for its gas deliveries as Europe's biggest economy struggles to rebalance its energy mix without Russian supplies. Robert Habeck rapped Washington for achieving what he called astronomical prices amid Europe's energy crisis. The U.S. is now providing 45% of Europe's liquefied natural gas, in which the continent is investing to make up for the Russian cuts. Meanwhile, the EU says it is ready to discuss a price cap on gas within the bloc to bring down soaring energy costs ahead of winter. That after over half of the 27-member bloc called for a price ceiling on gas imports. Russia has reduced its supplies to Europe in response to the West's crippling sanctions over the war in Ukraine. The The UN has announced the end of a truce in Yemen between the Ansarullah movement and the Saudi-led coalition. The Yemeni side is blaming Riyadh and its allies for failing to observe the UN-brokered armistice. The warring actors may be jockeying for position by allowing the deadline to pass, but that appears unlikely since fighting has resumed.
Back in April, a temporary UN-mediated ceasefire was reached between Yemen's Ansarullah movement and the Saudi-led coalition. It was renewed twice, leading to a respite from a bloody war that has ravaged the country for years, killing 150,000 people. The Saudi kingdom and its allies, most notably the United Arab Emirates, have been waging a war against Yemen since March 2015, trying in vain to reinstall the exiled Saudi-friendly regime of Abd Rabu Mansur Hadi. The military campaign, which has been enjoying arms, logistic, intelligence, and political support from the United States and some other Western countries, has killed hundreds of thousands of people and turned Yemen into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Now, the truce has ended, with sides failing to reach a consensus about the renewal of the ceasefire. In a statement, the Ansarullah movement has blamed the impasse on the Saudi-led coalition's failure to live up to its commitments and its reluctance to address humanitarian issues as a top priority. It also slammed Saudi Arabia and its allies for their refusal to talk about measures that would alleviate the suffering of the Yemeni people. Yemeni Foreign Minister Hisham Sharaf Abdullah also said the other side's failure to respond to the purely humanitarian demands presented by Sana'a has confirmed, beyond any doubt, its lack of seriousness in moving towards reaching a comprehensive and sustainable peaceful political settlement. Meanwhile, Yemen's armed forces have put oil companies operating in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates on notice, warning that they could be targeted as long as Riyadh and its allies fail to commit to a proper ceasefire. Sana'a says the coalition has repeatedly violated the humanitarian and military armistice. On April 10th, only a week after the agreement came into force, the Saudi coalition committed over 1,600 violations, including offensive operations, airstrikes, overflights by warplanes, spy planes, and Apache helicopters, as well as missile and artillery targets, resulting in the death of a number of people. And until the end of the ceasefire on October the 2nd, the number of violations of the coalition forces has reached over 34,500. So, apparently from the very beginning, Riyadh and its allies were not serious and honest about efforts to end the war.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Today is a day of celebration. We celebrate the start of the Imamate of Abu Saleh al-Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, the 12th infallible successor to the Holy Prophet of Islam and the promised saviour of mankind. Congratulations to all our Muslim listeners on this auspicious occasion.
Ocean of Dua. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
Ya Ilahi wa Rabbi wa Sayyidi wa Mawlai li ayy al umuri ilayka ashku wa lima minha adijju wa abki li alim al adabi wa shiddata
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing this part of the Kumail supplication. Ya Ilahi wa Rabbi wa Sayyidi wa Mawlai. My Lord, my Master and my Protector. Li ayyil umur ilayka ashku. For which things would I complain to you? Wa lima minha alijju wa abki. And for which of them would I lament and weep? Li alim al adhabi wa shiddati. أَمْ لِطُولِ الْبَلَاءِ وَمُدَّتِهِ For the length and period of tribulation, or for the pain and severity of chastisement. فَلَئِنْ صَيَّرْتَنِي لِلْعُقُوبَاتِ مَعَ أَعْدَائِكَ وَجَمَعْتَ بَيْنِي وَبَيْنَ أَهْلِ بَلَائِكَ وَفَرَّقْتَ بَيْنِي وَبَيْنَ أَحِبَّائِكَ وَأُولِيَائِكَ So my Lord, if you subject me to punishment with your enemies, if you gather me with the people of your tribulation, and if you separate me from your friends and saints, فَهَبْنِي يَا إِلَهِي وَسَيِّدِي وَمَوْلَايَ وَرَبِّي صَبَرْتُ عَلَىٰ عَذَابِكَ فَكَيْفَ أَصْبِرُ عَلَىٰ فِرَاقِكَ Then suppose, my Allah, my Master and my Protector, that I'm able to endure your chastisement. How can I endure separation from you?
وَهَبْنِي يَا إِلَهِي صَبَرْتُ عَلَىٰ حَرِّ نَارِكَ فَكَيْفَ أَصْبِرُ عَنِ النَّظَرِ إِلَىٰ كَرَامَتِكَ
Suppose I'm able to endure the heat of your fire. How can I endure not gazing upon your generosity?
أَمْ كَيْفَ أَسْكُنُ فِي النَّارِ وَرَجَاءِ عَفْوُكَ
Or how can I dwell in the fire while my hope is your pardon? This part of the Kumail supplication is a complaint to a friend. We talked about how important lamenting and weeping are and how it is important for some people as they have understood the importance of it, to be with the prophets, with the imams, and with the friends that they wish to see in this world. So they love to be accompanying them in hereafter. In this part, Imam Ali alayhi salam says,
فَلَئِنْ صَيَّرْتَنِي لِلْعُقُوبَاتِ مَعَ أَعْدَائِكَ وَجَمَعْتَ بَيْنِي وَبَيْنَ أَهْلِ بَلَائِكَ
If you subject me to punishment with your enemies, I mean, Imam Ali alayhi salam is not talking about the punishment. He's talking about the punishment with the enemies of the Almighty Allah.
وَجَمَعْتَ بَيْنِي وَبَيْنَ أَهْلِ بَلَائِكَ
O Allah, if you gather me with the people of your tribulation, if you separate me from your friends, it is implied that Imam Ali alayhi salam is saying, O Allah, suppose I can stand your burning fire, your chastisement, anything you deem necessary for me. But how can I ignore the blessings you grant your noble servants? It is narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that the Almighty has not created anyone except that he has defined a position in paradise and another in hell for him. When the inhabitants of the paradise settle in it and the hell inhabitants are sent to it, a caller tells the dwellers of paradise to look at their position in hell and says, This is the position that you would have entered if you had committed sins. So the dwellers of paradise get so relieved and happy that if there were any death in paradise, they would die of happiness. Afterwards, this caller calls the dwellers of hell to look up their supposed position and blessings in paradise and says, if you had worshipped Allah, you could have won these positions. So the inhabitants of hell get so depressed that they nearly die if there were any death in hell.
Oh my God, my Lord, my King and Master, which of the matters shall I complain to you, and for which of them shall I wail and weep? Shall I wail for the pains of the punishment and its intensity, or for the length of my suffering and its duration?
Thank you, Allah, that we hear, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
Brothers and sisters, that's why it is so important to stay with the close friends of the Almighty Allah, with the divine men in this world, to accompany them in hereafter as well. The Ahlul Bayt, the vicegerents of the Almighty Allah, are the Holy Quran's counterpart. We all know that this is our responsibility to understand the Holy Quran and put it into practice, to understand its teachings, just as shown by the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Allah has purified the Ahlul Bayt from uncleanness. Allah has made them infallible. So we can say the Ahlul Bayt are the protected Quran. They contain all the meanings of the Holy Quran. They are completely aware of its manifest and hidden verses and the ones practicing the Holy Quran's teachings. I mean, they are the practical examples of the Holy Quran. They are the full embodiment, full manifestations of the Book of Allah. So these people should be completely followed by the ones who consider themselves as the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. Their teachings should be followed by the lovers of the Ahlul Bayt in this world to be saved from the hellfire and to be accompanying them in the next world. And this is so important that Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions it in this part of the Divine Kumail supplication. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode of the program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Our fast-paced lives have been made possible by advanced technologies. On a broader scale, technology has changed major sectors over the past 20 years, including healthcare, telecommunication, energy, and so much more. And knowledge-based products in particular have increased safety, speed, and efficiency in manufacturing sectors. Productions in this field have brought numerous social and economic advantages while generating billions of dollars in revenue, making them indispensable for Iran's economic growth.
Hello again and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm your host Ali Reza Ikhtiarzadeh, and this week we're going to look at the activities of Iranian knowledge-based companies. We wanted to see how they help advance various industries and explore why their dedicated efforts are so important to the country. Plus, we will check out some of their contributions to the national economy as a whole. So, let's get started.
We hear the phrase knowledge-based enterprise thrown around a lot these days, but some might be wondering what we mean by a knowledge-based company. Interestingly, there is no agreed-on definition because of the broad range of their activities. However, they all have one thing in common. They use intangible assets such as intellectual property and depend heavily on innovation as a competitive source. To get a clearer idea of knowledge-based enterprises, we visited one in Semnan province to understand what they do. With decades of experience, this company specializes in making various types of gas turbines, blades, and parts. All production here begins in the design room. Based on requirements, parts are designed, then a prototype is created using wax. Later, the wax models are used to create precise molds, which are then cast with metal. It produces products along the lines of exports, meaning that all production stages strictly follow national and international standards for quality and safety, making them compatible with international regulations and ready for market destinations abroad. Items manufactured here are used to make gas turbines. It supplies equipment to Iran's national gas distribution grids, which feed gas to cities, oil refineries, power plants, and other industries through pipes that stretch across the country. You might find it interesting that these advanced services and technologies were previously imported. This means there was a certain dependency on foreign companies to get such items, which created a lot of expensive complications. Knowledge-based companies such as the one we just mentioned
are among the pioneers of indigenizing this technology, saving the country millions of dollars on imports.
The beating heart of any knowledge-based company is its research and development department. Here, new products are created after vast amounts of studies. It is where science and knowledge meet method and production. It is also the place where the quality of products is put to the test. But it's not just a single room. This company has dedicated vast amounts of space to these activities, which also house advanced lab technology and testing equipment. Generally speaking, knowledge-based companies employ specialists and university graduates that handle important tasks. These individuals are the glue or the bridge between knowledge and production. Highly skilled and expert staff is one of the main advantages of this competitive market. Like many businesses across the country, this firm has overcome many obstacles to enjoy its numerous achievements. One such challenge has been the U.S.-imposed sanctions. However, it has come up with its own unique approach, which has turned this obstacle into a massive opportunity. All things considered, there are numerous investment opportunities in this production field, particularly regarding research and development of products that do not currently exist in the market. This knowledge-based company has never stopped eyeing the future. It plans to expand its product list and optimize its production while improving items it already manufactures. The company we just talked about is one part of the giant puzzle that makes up the knowledge-based industry. The government has supported the shift to a knowledge-based society for decades, yet this shift has been more apparent in recent years. Such support has paved the way for boosting innovation and scientific progress, leading to many economic advantages. In 2010, Iran passed several laws promoting and supporting these enterprises, strengthening a legal framework for the growth of the knowledge-based ecosystem. These efforts have paid off in many ways. Since 2013, knowledge-based companies and startups have grown over 140-fold to 7,000 active units today. These firms make thousands of specialized technologies that have massively reduced the country's dependency on foreign imports. Moreover, these businesses have increased developments in the production of medical devices, energy, agriculture, ICT, aircraft maintenance, mining, petrochemicals, biotechnology, and so much more. In fact, Iran also exports a lot of specialized products. According to figures from the National Innovation Fund, tech firms and knowledge-based companies raked in over $5 billion in revenues last year. In total, presently, Iran's knowledge-based ecosystem accounts for more than 3% of the country's gross domestic product. That's going off of statistics from the Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology. So far, the government has implemented numerous policies and plans to help support knowledge-based companies over the years. These schemes include loans with low interest rates, tax exemptions, and easing commercial license issuances. The goal is to encourage the development of Iran's tech ecosystem and boost lucrative high-tech productions for exports. Iran is no stranger to the handwoven carpet market. Traditionally, the country has been weaving carpets for millennia with skills passed down through generations, some even as highly protected family secrets. Iranians were among the pioneers of weaving carpets, and with years of experience, they have achieved a great deal of perfection in this arena. The craft has represented Iran's rich culture and heritage for centuries and has been adored all over the world. Our quest for answers led us to the 29th International Exhibition of Handmade Iranian Carpets. This event is viewed by many industry participants as the world's largest handmade carpet expo when it comes to quantity and quality. Visitors were dazzled by thousands of handwoven carpets in all sorts of contemporary and traditional design patterns. The exhibition is a place for national and international trade and commercial envoys to visit in order to size up the market and make business deals. All sorts of carpets are found here that were brought in from all corners of Iran, including very rare rugs. We caught up with a few vendors to see what type of activities they carry out. A high-quality Iranian carpet can cost thousands of dollars, with antique rugs fetching even higher prices. There is so much variety to choose from the floral designs of Isfahan to the intricate fine details of Qom carpets and the strong compact Bijar rugs made in western Kurdish villages. The list goes on and on. However, most carpets are not valued based on knot count, but rather because of their materials, design, and overall size. While some rug varieties follow specific designs, most are entirely improvised, with the weaver adding traditional motifs and their personal design touch to the carpet. Handwoven with the finest materials, including wool and silk, a single Persian rug can often take years and sometimes decades to create. Most handwoven carpets are produced in rural areas. Furthermore, women make up the majority of carpet weavers and produce raw materials such as silk and wool in rural areas. Such collectives safeguard the rights and income of weavers who frequently receive the least profit from their products. This is mainly due to numerous middlemen businesses that make money from carpets. Cooperatives also serve another purpose. They organize the production chain by linking material producers with weavers and buyers to complete a production cycle. The massive exhibition is one of the best places to get a bird's eye view of this thriving market. Yes, ironically, one of the biggest importers of Iranian handmade carpets used to be the United States. This is followed by European countries. However, owing to the U.S.-imposed sanctions, Americans were forced to find alternate avenues to satisfy their cravings for these highly coveted carpets. For centuries, the Iranian carpet has represented the country's rich culture and art. Its stunning design and exquisite quality have turned the ancient craft into a lucrative commodity sought after by many across the world. But Iran's handwoven carpet exports have also seen numerous ups and downs over the decades. Industry participants say the U.S. sanctions tried to pull the rug out from under the Persian carpet legacy. But the move didn't work and only seems to have increased the world's demand for these items. 1994 was the golden period for Iranian handwoven carpet exports. Back then, exports peaked at over $2 billion. Later down the road, the U.S. imposed a ban on Persian rugs in 2010. After signing a 2015 nuclear deal, the ban was lifted only to be reimposed after Washington unilaterally pulled out of the accord in 2018. That's also around the time when cheap knockoffs of Persian rugs made by Asian countries began flooding the market. Either way, authentic handwoven rugs from Iran still hold their place in the market despite roller coaster exports. The industry is gradually bouncing back. According to Iran's Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture, the country still maintains first place in exports of handwoven carpets worldwide. Based on figures from the National Customs Administration, exports of handwoven carpets increased to nearly 85% in terms of value in the first 2 months of 2021 alone. According to the National Carpet Center of Iran, last year the country exported some $64 million worth of these items. Also, production went up after the coronavirus pandemic as many craftspeople who had left the sector returned, causing a production jump of around 400%. All right, while I take a quick little break here, I'll be back shortly.
Hey everyone, welcome to another special feature of Bazaar. I'm your host Ali Reza, and today we're checking out a knowledge-based company that is saving the country around $20 million worth of imports annually by managing to produce inhaler capsules that we use to import from foreign countries through in-house knowledge, research, and technology. Stay tuned to find out how they did it.
Patients with asthma or dyspnea need to use inhalers to get the prescribed drug into their lungs. That requires not just the active substance of the drug, but also a sort of carrier to take the drug into your lungs before it is fully absorbed in your mouth, before it even gets down your trachea. You will find them mixed with the active substance in inhaler capsules that the inhaler punctures once you put the capsule in, which then you inhale.
Our journey begins in the storage room where they bring in the raw material, the active substance for these inhaler capsules in the form of tiotropium bromide. Now, this company produces 45 million of these inhaler capsules annually for the 150 to 200,000 patients in the country that are prescribed to use them. And they use not more than 1 kilogram of this active substance, this tiotropium bromide, to make all of these. Now let's check out the production line to see how it's actually made.
The raw material in the form of a small amount of tiotropium bromide, as well as the excipients, which would be the aforementioned carriers that mix with the active substance, are then sent to the production line along with the gelatin capsules themselves, which would later be filled with our formulation substance, the mixture of our active substance and the excipients.
So before we get into the actual production line, first they bring the raw material from the storage room to allocate to determine what amount of each formulation material they need to bring into the production line. So that includes the active substance, the aforementioned tiotropium bromide, and the excipients, which is the additive substances. So once they've allocated the necessary amounts of those, they bring it to the production line, which we will check out now.
Perhaps the biggest challenge in this production line is the mixing of an infinitely small amount of active substance with the excipients to get a completely uniform mixture of our formulation substance that you would find inside the capsules. The production line would have to be sensitive enough to mix 18 micrograms of tiotropium bromide with 10 milligrams of excipients in a completely uniform way. 1 microgram, by the way, is 1/1000th of a gram.
There's actually very little substance in it. And that is because the capsule filling machine is capable of microdosing, which after we bring the formulated powder from the previous process, this machine can fill this container, this little capsule, with just 10 milligrams worth of powder, formulated powder, which is not a capability that a lot of capsule filling machines are capable of. So once this capsule is filled with our 10 milligrams worth of formulated substance, we then go to the container filling room.
The containers that have been filled with exactly 30 capsules are brought to be labeled, then packaged, to be sent back into the warehouse, to be sent to pharmacies, and get in the hands of patients. But before that happens, they need to go through one final stage of quality assurance. Because this company has managed to fully domesticize the production technology of this particular product, they're able to save 90% of the currency that would otherwise be spent on procuring this very product for the patients in the country through imports. That is $9 million worth of savings, and they're fully capable of doing that because their production line allows for even leftover for exports. Because of the competitive pricing of the aforementioned tiotropium bromide capsules, the value of the potential exports of this product is estimated to be around $30 million.
And now we're at the quality control lab, and one of the most important quality control procedures that they do is to test the actual performance of the formula and the capsule. So what they do is they use a regular inhaler as a normal patient would. They would insert the capsule in it and use the lung simulator. So they would insert the inhaler, and with the help of a vacuum pump attached to this flow regulator attached to the simulator itself, they simulate the flow of a normal human inhale and see how much of the formula is administered to different stages of the lung. Each of these circles has these holes on them, which gets exponentially smaller the lower you go, to the point that at the bottom you don't really even see any of these holes. And the residue left by the formula through this inhale, we test out to see how much of the formula is left on each stage, and then we would see whether the residue left is to the measures up to the amount that we wanted it to, and that pretty much concludes the test, the performance test for our formula, and that also pretty much concludes this episode of Boaz Earth. Take care, and bye-bye. For our final portion of the program, let's check out some news and trends in the knowledge-based industries. The activities of knowledge-based companies are not just limited to Iran's borders. They have also headed to Venezuela to kick off a tech and science fair showcasing Iran's latest technological achievements. Nearly 80 Iranian firms participated alongside hundreds of Venezuelan companies in the fair. They offered products and services in numerous fields such as oil, gas, health, pharmaceuticals, agriculture, and machinery. The goal is to exchange experiences, knowledge, and services and deepen Iran's trade ties with the Latin American country. The expo was launched by Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. During the ceremony, Maduro announced that four fuel-efficient Iranian car models would be assembled in his country and released into the Venezuelan market. One trend we are seeing these days is the increased activity of biotech companies. In fact, right now, knowledge-based products from this sector hold 40% of the country's total pharmaceutical exports to show for it. That's based on the Association of Manufacturers and Exporters of Medical Biotechnology Products. Biotech refers to the use of living systems and organisms to develop products. According to the association, these products have saved the country millions in foreign exchange. Additionally, these knowledge-based companies have made Iran self-sufficient in biotech production. This sector exports its products to European, Asian, and Latin American countries while competing with other items in the international arena. That covers our program for today. On behalf of the entire Bazaar team, thank you for tuning in and bye for now. Until then.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.